Amen. Very good. We are not going to talk about much of the Torah portion. The Torah portion, of course, is Bamidbar, which in Hebrew means in the wilderness. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, this book of the Bible is called Bamidbar because Bamidbar occurs in the first sentence of the first verse. Okay? And that's how the portions are named, based upon a significant term in the first sentence or the first verse of each portion. Okay? Now, this portion, if you have read it, is about the census that is taken from among the tribes of Israel. The census in the book of Numbers is quite a big deal. This is a census that is taken as the wilderness journey begins, and then there is a census taken at the end of the book of Numbers, just prior to Israel's conquest of the land. And what's interesting about it is that when you compare the totals, you'll see that some tribes increase, some tribes decrease, but the net result of the census taking is that the tribes as a whole, the people of Israel as a whole, are smaller. There are fewer Israelites at the end of the wilderness sojourn than there are in the beginning. Okay? So, I would like to make a couple of comments about the concept of wilderness. And the commentary that we're going to read, in this case by Jonathan Sacks, makes an observation about wilderness as well. Okay? So instead of talking about some of the details related to the actual census, which I have talked about on several occasions, so again, I would just encourage you to access the audio portion of a previous teaching if you're interested in some of the nuts and bolts about the actual census itself. But I want to talk about wilderness because the term Bamidbar, because of the way it is translated in many English translations, Westerners tend to think of something that isn't true. Okay? Of course, in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting," and the NIV, for example, says, "in the desert of Sinai." Right? So, for most of us living in Western cultures, when we think of desert, we think of the Sahara Desert. We think of sand dunes, right? Now, the fact of the matter is that in the wilderness, in the Negev, in the Sinai Peninsula, in portions of it, there are sand dunes. But they don't stretch for miles and miles and miles and miles. You know, they don't cover hundreds of square miles like some of the great world deserts do, like the Gobi Desert or the Sahara Desert or other vast deserts on the planet, right? In other words, you have probably all seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia or other movies that show desert, right? They show people traversing the desert. They're on camels and there is absolutely nothing in the desert but sand and heat that radiates during the daytime from the desert floor and the cold at night because that's the way desert is. Well, the desert, Bamidbar, Midbar in Hebrew, doesn't mean a sand desert. If you look in your notes, I have desert or wilderness, not meaning a barren, burning, sandy waste in the case of Sinai and Israel or Palestine. Sand is the exception, not the rule. So in Sinai, there are some little sections, and in the Negev too, that contains sand, but it's very rare. Okay? Even still, it is diversified by oases and verdant valleys with wells. Much more formally, for traces exist in many parts of Egyptian miners' smelting furnaces, right? So you have to think of the wilderness, at least in terms of Midbar, what Midbar means. It can be translated desert because the desert is a place where no one lives or very few people live. But the term can also be translated pasture land, right? Where I live in Northern California, there are vast stretches of pasture land, right? They are green in the spring and they are brown in the summer and in the fall. And then, of course, with the fall rains and the winter rains, they turn green again, right? But they are used mostly for pasturing cattle. There is a lot of cattle up here. So they are vast, vast stretches of land that are mostly grasslands. Well, in Hebrew, we would call that Midbar, right? In other words, it's not desert at all in the way that people think of desert. It just means an area that is not cultivated, an area where people don't live, which doesn't mean that no one lives in the wilderness or no one lives in the desert, right? There are a lot of animals and wildlife. There's plants. It's just not a cultivated or civilized area. So does that make sense? Because in Hebrew, the contrast is between the wilderness, which is quiet, and developed areas, which are noisy. Do you understand? So in Hebrew, when we think of wilderness, you don't even necessarily have to think or to imagine the landscape, because the landscape is obviously connected to it, but the landscape is only, well, I was going to say peripherally connected to the concept of silence, the concept of quietness, right? So, the wilderness is a place of quiet, and towns and villages and cities in biblical times, and of course it's still true today, is a place of noise. They are noisy. Cities are noisy, and the wilderness is quiet. Okay? Now, if you look in your notes, what's really interesting about the way this works is I have the word Midbar. And I have the English words that are used to translate it. And I have three of the Hebrew consonants in red. The Dalet, the Beit, and the Resh. Okay? Well, notice that the Dalet, the Beit, and the Resh, the root letters that make up the word Midbar, wilderness, are also the root letters that make up the word Davar, which means word or matter or thing. And of course, the Hebrew word daber, which means to speak to, speak with, speak about. But in its different verbal forms, it can also mean to threaten or to promise. Or it can be used in the sense of a command. Like when the Lord spoke to Moses, for example, that's the word that's used, daber. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, right? So what's interesting about it is that in Hebrew, there is a connection between the concept of speaking and the quietness that is required to hear it, right? And I'm not just talking about a quietness in terms of the noise level or the noise ratio. I'm talking about an inner quietness that makes it possible to hear something, either to hear the voice of God or to hear the voice of a spouse or a child or a friend. And obviously, I'm not just talking about hearing the sounds that a person makes with their mouth when they talk. I'm talking about hearing with the heart. Okay? So, before we get into Sachs's commentary, which addresses some of these questions too, I want you to understand the profound connection in Hebrew thought between the concept of a word or a promise or the idea of speaking and the related concept of listening, right? And the quiet that is required to hear it. Now, I don't know what any of you really do for a living. I mean, obviously I know in some cases. I don't know how busy you are. I don't know what your day looks like, right? But I do know that if you're a busy person, I know the great value that Shabbat provides someone with a very, very busy schedule. Why? Because Shabbat is a time when we're supposed to disconnect with the world. We're supposed to disconnect with our harried existence, our busy schedules. Shabbat is supposed to be a time to wind down, to be quiet before the Lord, to be quiet before your spouse, your children, your grandchildren, whatever it might be, a time to be able to interact with people, friends, without all of the noise that typically characterizes our lives. You know, the emails, the messages that we have to return, because Shabbat is one of those days that we just don't really pay as much attention to those things as we do during the rest of the week when we have to, if we don't want to get fired from whatever job we work at. You understand? So all of these ideas are connected. So, Sachs wrote a really good commentary, an article, on this Torah portion, in which he focuses on the concept of wilderness as well. He calls it the sound of silence. Okay? Bamidbar is usually read on the Shabbat before Shavuot. Now, this is the Shabbat before Shavuot. I think Shavuot is Monday. So the sages connected the two. Shavuot is the time of the giving of the Torah. Bamidbar, by the way, that's one of the reasons why the Torah readings are manipulated in some cases, because there's 54 readings and only 52 weeks of the year, and there are certain Sabbaths in which certain Torah portions have to be read at certain times, right? In other words, Bamidbar is one of them. It's always read on the Sabbath before Shavuot. So that's why, depending upon how the rest of the year lays out, that's why sometimes two Sabbath portions are connected together, right? Because they want to make sure that certain Torah portions are read on the Sabbath that they must be read or are supposed to be read in order to make the proper connection between the portion and some event, holiday event that takes place. Okay? At any rate, so the sages connected the two, Bamidbar and Shavuot. Okay? But of course, Bamidbar has nothing to do with the giving of the Torah, right? Which is what Shavuot, the Festival of Weeks, is all about. So what is the connection between Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, when the Torah was given to the Jewish people, which we read about in Exodus 20, right? I mean, that occurred books ago. The connection between Shavuot and Bamidbar has to do with the fact that the giving of the Torah took place in the wilderness. It took place in a quiet spot. That's what the connection is. Okay? Shavuot is the time of the giving of the Torah. Bamidbar means in the desert. What then is the connection between the desert and the Torah, the wilderness, and God's Word? The sages gave several interpretations. According to the Michilta, which is a midrash, it's a well-known midrash that is quite often referred to. It's technically a midrash on the book of Exodus, but it includes a lot of other portions as well. The Torah was given publicly, openly, and in a place no one owns, because had it been given in the land of Israel, Jews would have said to the nations of the world, "You have no share in it." Instead, and this is an incredibly, incredibly important point, instead, whoever wants to come and accept it, let them come and accept it. Do you understand? It's a very important idea. In other words, the Torah was given in a place that no one owns because it isn't the purview of a particular people or a particular nation. It's for anyone who wants to embrace it, Jew and Gentile alike. And that's an incredibly important lesson. And of course, Rabbi Sacks is drawing on his knowledge of rabbinic literature. But one of the places where this concept is mentioned is in Numbers Rabbah, the great midrash on the book of Numbers, where it says in chapter 1, paragraph 7, "The Lord spoke unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai." And then in the midrash it asks, why in the wilderness of Sinai? Our sages have inferred from this that the Torah was given to the accompaniment of three things: fire, water, and wilderness. Right? Okay? I don't have the time probably to read this all the way through, but if you go down to the next paragraph, it explains why fire, water, and wilderness, and of course it quotes from various books from the Bible. Why was the giving of the Torah marked by these three features? To indicate, as these are free to all mankind, so also are the words of the Torah free. And then it quotes a passage from the book of Isaiah, "Ho, everyone that thirsts, come ye for the water." Right? So, of course, the Torah is likened to water, and our spiritual appetite is likened to a hunger or a thirst. And, of course, we are thirsty for God's Word. Since God's Word is the Torah, whatever hunger we have for God and for His Word, that translates as a hunger for the Torah. And of course, it isn't just Jewish people who have a hunger for Torah, it's Gentiles too, right? So, Gentiles can make the Torah their own as well. So, it's an important midrashic concept that Israel received the divine Torah, not only on its own behalf, but Israel is essentially acting as a trustee for all mankind. Now, this is obviously a problem in Christian thought, because in Christian teaching, the Torah was abolished when Yeshua was executed on the cross. Right? And of course, it doesn't explain why, according to the Bible, when the Messiah comes, the law, or the Torah, will cover the earth as water covers the sea, which is obviously pretty completely, right? So, the Torah will be the law of not only Israel in the millennium when the Messiah rules and reigns from Jerusalem over the earth. The Torah will be the law for all nations, not just Israel at that time. And of course, It will be the basis for the judgment of the nations that occurs when the Messiah comes. There are many passages which speak of this. At any rate, another explanation back to Sachs: had the Torah been given in Israel, the nations of the world would have had an excuse for not accepting it. So, of course, the implication is that the nations of the world are supposed to accept the Torah. This follows the rabbinic tradition that before God gave the Torah to the Israelites, he offered it to all the other nations, and each found a reason to decline. And, of course, there is this wonderful rabbinic story that speaks about the fact that God went to each nation, and he offered them the Torah. And each nation asks God, well, what does the Torah say? And God quotes from a passage from the Torah, something like, you shall not steal. And the people say, well, you know, we can't, we're going to have a problem with that one. So no, I guess we can't accept your Torah. And every nation had a reason why they couldn't accept or embrace the Torah, which is what makes Israel's acceptance of the Torah so remarkable. Because they don't ask any questions of God, what does the Torah say? They just say, we will do it. And then, we will hear it. In other words, all the other nations had to hear it before they did it, before they committed to doing it. And in Israel's case, they just assumed that if it's from God, it's good. Sure, we'll accept the Torah, we'll take it, we'll do it, and then we'll come to appreciate what it means and how it works, and all of that stuff will come at some point along the way. You know, so Israel's acceptance of the Torah was very remarkable in the scripture. At any rate, there is another explanation. Just as the wilderness is free, and this, of course, is based upon our Midrash, it costs nothing to enter. The Torah is free. It is God's gift to us. But there is another more spiritual reason. The desert is a place of silence, according to Sachs. There is nothing visually to distract you, and there is no ambient noise to muffle sound. I don't know if you have ever been to a place where there is no sound, but I can remember years ago some friends of mine and I went camping out in the desert. And we went very, very far away from everything. And this was a wilderness area, just like the wilderness area is in biblical times. And we went so far away from civilization that you could not hear a single sound. There were no sounds. No trains, no planes, no animal sounds. Absolutely nothing. You know, the remarkable thing is that it took about a day and a half for the ear to stop vibrating and hear it. To hear the silence. Or to hear the lack of sound, right? Because your eardrum is so constantly inundated with sound that it's always vibrating. And everybody's ear, they were buzzing, right? I mean, from the residual sound of the city. And it took a couple of days before our ears adjusted to the silence. And of course, once it adjusted to the silence, it was, you know, it's an awesome quietness. At any rate, he says that the desert is a place of silence and there is nothing to distract you. There is no ambient noise to muffle sound. To be sure, when the Israelites received the Torah, there was thunder and lightning and the sound of a shofar. The earth felt as if it were shaking at its foundations. But in a later age, when the prophet Elijah stood at the same mountain under his confrontation with the after his confrontation with the prophets of Baal, he encountered God, not in the whirlwind or the fire or the earthquake, but in the kol demamah dakah, the still small voice. Literally, the sound of a slender silence. I define this as the sound you can hear only if you are listening. And for sex, he means only if you are listening with your heart. In the silence of Midbar, the desert or the wilderness, you can hear the Medaber, the speaker, and the Medubar, that which is spoken, right? And you can see that the word Midbar, desert, Medaber, speaker, and Medubar, that which is spoken, they're all built from the same root, right? To hear the voice of God, you need a listening silence in the soul. And of course, there are many passages in which this listening silence is referred to, and many passages in the prophetic literature when the opposite is true of God's people. Like in this passage in Jeremiah chapter 5, when God says, "Hear this, you foolish and senseless people, who have eyes but do not see, who have ears but do not hear." Right? Of course they see with their eyes and hear with their ears, but that isn't what Jeremiah is referring to, or what God is referring to when he criticizes them for not seeing with their eyes and not hearing with their ears. What is he talking about? They have stubborn and rebellious hearts, right? So they see with their eyes. Of course they see with their eyes. That's what you do with eyes. You see. But they don't see God work. They don't see what God is doing, how God is acting or moving among them, right? And of course they hear with their ears, but they don't apprehend what God is saying in their heart, right? So, of course, this criticism is also a criticism that Yeshua levels against people in his time, when he comes, particularly some of the religious leaders, and he also commends others for hearing, right? For example, in Matthew 11, he says, "If you are willing to accept it, John is the Elijah who is to come. Whoever has ears, let him hear." In other words, listen to what I'm saying. The Bible requires that the Messiah be preceded by a forerunner. The one who precedes the coming of the Messiah in the last days is Elijah. Right? That's what the Bible says. But of course, here I am on this occasion. So, this occasion requires a forerunner as well. And so Yeshua says, John, Yochanan HaMatbil, John the Baptist, he is fulfilling, at my first coming, the role that Elijah will fulfill when I come again. That's essentially what Yeshua is saying. And then he says, whoever has ears, let him hear. Let this concept or idea penetrate your heart so that the fact that it's John and not Elijah is not a stumbling block to your coming to terms with who I am. Do you understand? That's essentially it. Yeshua says the same thing after he tells the parable of the sower in Matthew 13, right? He talks about the sower who sows seed in the four types of soil. And of course, it doesn't make sense for the sower to sow seed in the three types of soil. I have a garden in my yard, right? I don't put seeds in areas like where there's thorns, or I don't drop seeds on the gravel road in front of my driveway, and I don't put seed among the rocks, right? I mean, who does that? The fact is, I put seeds, when I plant seeds, in potting soil, right? In a protected environment, particularly until it sprouts. I water it carefully, I prepare the soil carefully, I make sure it gets enough sun, I do everything that I mean, because I want these seeds to sprout, right? I want cantaloupe, or I want cucumbers, or I want artichokes, or whatever it is. The point is that I try to take care of it until I have the fruit. That's the objective, right? But here, the four soils are the four types of hearts of Yeshua's first century audience. And only one of the four types of hearts is the heart that hears, right? That listens to what Yeshua is saying. And of course, in the same passage, he commends those for hearing, and he criticizes those for not hearing. And he criticizes them by saying essentially what Jeremiah does, that they see with their eyes, but don't see. They hear with their ears, but don't hear. They don't see or hear what's important, right? At any rate, many years ago, British television produced a documentary series called The Long Search on the world's great religions. Sachs continues, when it came to Judaism, the presenter, Robert Ronald Erie, seemed surprised by its blooming, buzzing confusion, especially the loud, argumentative voices in the Beit Midrash, the house of study. Remarking on this to Elie Wiesel, he asked, is there such a thing in Judaism as silence? And of course, he's talking about the Beit Midrash, the house of study, but he could just as easily be talking about a synagogue. I don't know how many of you have ever been to a synagogue, but it's not a quiet place either, right? I mean, it tends to be a noisy place. I mean, it's not like it's crazy noisy, particularly when the Torah is being read, but we sing, we chant, we recite prayers, we don't say them out loud, but kind of under our breath, but they're kind of mumbled. And when you're in a room with 100 people mumbling prayers, it's noisy, right? It's not like it's quiet. There isn't quiet. And there's children running around. It's just not the kind of staid, quiet, austere, respectable attitude that characterizes other places of worship. And it's funny, so Elie Wiesel was a Holocaust survivor who became a Nobel laureate, great writer. He wrote, his most famous book is probably called Night, about his experiences in the Holocaust. Anyway, he died a couple of years ago. But anyway, he asked Elie Wiesel, is there such a thing as silence in Judaism? And Wiesel replied, Judaism is full of silences, but we don't talk about them. It was a great statement. Judaism is a very verbal culture, a religion of holy words. Through words, God created the universe, and God said, let there be, and there was. According to the Targum, which is an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Bible, originally translated as the Hebrew is being recited, so it was a spontaneous translation, ultimately written down. It is our ability to speak that makes us human. It translates the phrase, the man became a living soul, as the man became a speaking soul. So the ability to communicate is very, very important in terms of our connection with each other and in terms of our connection with God. Words create, words communicate. Our relationships are shaped, for good or bad, by language. Now, as it turns out, humans aren't the only beings on the planet that communicate with each other. Right? Bees communicate, dolphins communicate, killer whales communicate, gorillas communicate, elephants communicate. They don't communicate in quite the same way we do, but we shouldn't think of them as objects, which is the way the wildlife on the planet is typically treated, as just objects that we possess that we can do whatever it is that we want with, right? Because that doesn't reflect a correct biblical mandate regarding our relationship with the earth. At any rate, our relationships are shaped for good or bad by language. Much of Judaism is about the power of words to make or break worlds. So, silence in Tanakh often has a negative connotation. Aaron was silent, says the Torah, after the death of his two sons, Nadav and Avihu. We read about that in Leviticus 10. The dead do not praise you, it says in Psalms 115, nor do those who go down to the silence of the grave. Okay? But that's because the body is in a state of silence in the grave. It doesn't talk. The body doesn't, right? Of course, the soul is with God. So, of course, it communicates with God, right? But not from our perspective. When Job's friends came to confront him after the loss of his children and other afflictions, they sat down with him on the ground for 7 days and seven nights, yet no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. So this reflects the biblical or the rabbinic notion that when someone is grieving and in great pain, that words have very little impact. It's one of the things that we talked about in our study of Pirkei Avot. Okay, at any rate, it's better just to be a supportive presence. At any rate, but not all silence is sad. Psalm tells us that to you, silence is praise. In Psalm 65, what does it mean that silence is praise? If we are truly in awe at the greatness of God, the vastness of the universe, and the almost infinite extent of time, our deepest emotions will indeed lie too deep for words. We will experience silent communion. Right? So silence in the Psalms is not talking. Do you understand? It's not just not talking. In other words, in the Psalms, when I am not silent, it doesn't mean I'm not talking. It means that I'm experiencing a quietness in God's presence that is too profound for words. There's a big difference between those two things. Okay? The sages valued silence. They called it a fence to wisdom. From Avot, Pirkei Avot. If words are worth a coin, silence is worth two, according to the Talmud in Megillah. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, all my days I have grown up among the wise and have found nothing better than silence. Now, I don't want to run out of time, but I do need to make a brief comment about these two concepts. There are many passages which speak of this, but I want to just highlight a couple of concepts or ideas and ask you to read these on your own. In Pirkei Avot chapter 3, In our version, the book that we studied, it's verse or paragraph 17. Rabbi Akiva says, mockery and levity accustom a man to immorality. The transmitted oral Torah is a protective fence around the Torah, a boundary. It prevents you from violating the Torah. A tithes are a protective fence for wealth. The faithful giving of a tithe insulates one against becoming too greedy. Vows are a protective fence for abstinence. In other words, vows facilitate abstinence, and a protective fence for wisdom is silence. So what does this mean? Fools, if you look at this passage in Proverbs 29, fools give full vent to their rage, but the wise bring calm in the end. In other words, a fool is someone who just utters things without saying, but a wise person thinks about what they're going to say before they say it. In other words, they don't react immediately with boisterous conversation or monologue or boisterous speech. They're silent because they have to think about what they want to say. And it's interesting because, of course, in the Proverbs it says, in Proverbs 17, even fools are thought wise if they keep silent, and discerning if they hold their tongues, right? But the idea is that it is suggested that this was asserted with specific regard to those thoughts that are best left unarticulated, especially those that affect the relationships between people. In other words, it's okay not to say everything you think. Right? In other words, you don't have to open your mouth and immediately respond every time you're asked a question. It's okay not to respond for a few seconds. It's okay to think about what you want to say. And if whether or not that's a question you want to answer, should answer, is a good idea to answer, because sometimes there is more wisdom in not answering a question than there is in answering a question, right? It just kind of depends on the question. Okay? Now, the other thing is with Shimon, his son says, and this is in chapter 1, verse 17, and this, of course, is Shimon ben Gamliel, not Akiva's son, but Gamliel's son. All my days I have been raised among the sages, and I've found nothing better for oneself than silence. Not study, but practice is the main thing. And one who talks excessively brings on sin. Now, what's important about this concept is the idea of silence. A man who lacks judgment derides his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his tongue. Okay? So silence is not necessarily, as I mentioned, not talking, but it does obviously involve being quiet at times. But it's an inner quietness that is manifest on occasion by waiting to express yourself. Okay? In James, for example, he says, my dear brothers, take note. Everyone should be quick to listen and slow to speak and slow to become angry. For man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. And of course, you've heard the expression that we have two ears and one mouth, so that we will listen twice as much as we talk. Right? I mean, everybody has heard that, right? It's a cute cliche that resonates with what James just said. Okay? Now, in the Talmud, in Pesachim, the tractate on Passover, Ben Kapara taught, silence is seemingly for the wise, all the more so for fools. Thus Solomon said, even a fool, when he holds his peace, is counted wise. And it goes without saying that it is so when a wise man holds his peace too. Okay? Now listen to this passage from the Talmud. Chulin. Rabbi Isaac said, what is meant by what is prudent for men? Silence. Yet speak the truth. Okay? Do you Do you understand that in Western thought, this sentence is essentially an oxymoron? It's a phrase which expresses a concept that is impossible. It's not possible to make sense out of it. Silence, yet speak the truth. Well, if you're silent, how can you speak the truth? Right? So in Greek, in Western thought, to a Western mind, silence is the opposite of talking. Because you're either silent or you're not silent. You're either talking or you're not talking. Like right now, I'm talking, you're quiet. Now, you might be talking among yourselves, which is something that we just can't hear because your microphones are muted. But the point is, I'm talking, you're silent. That's what Greeks think of, or Westerners think of, when they think of the words talking and silent, or speaking and being silent, right? When Paul says, for example, that he doesn't, that, you know, that a woman shouldn't speak, Westerners, of course, take that to mean that in congregational matters, women shouldn't talk, right? But of course, for Paul, he was Jewish. He wasn't thinking in terms of Western values or a Western cultural orientation. Paul wasn't thinking that speaking is the opposite of silence. He was thinking about something completely differently that has nothing to do with the way Westerners tend to understand that passage based upon its rendering in English, right? So, what is prudent for men? Silence, yet speaking the truth. It means, what is good policy for a man in this world? To make himself out as mute, lest it be thought that a man should also remain mute in debate on Torah. The psalm goes on to say, yet speak you the truth. In other words, our lives should be characterized by an inner quietness, by an inner silence that reflects an awe of God, an awe of God's work, an awe of God's sovereignty, a respect for others, a sense of humility in the presence of others, and a recognition that others, regardless of what they believe, that regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their sexual orientation, regardless of any other box that you can manage to squeeze someone into, deserve to be treated with dignity and respect, right? Because they were also, like you, created in God's image. So this is a remarkable, remarkable idea. So silence in Jewish thought is not talking. Silence in Jewish thought is having the kind of regard for God and others that means that we don't arrogantly affirm our theological point of view over that of others, or, you know, put others down by our speech, by our actions, because we're supposed to be regulated by this internal connection with God, right? I hope this makes sense. By the way, these notes from Pirkei Avot are from the workbook on Pirkei Avot. A woman, like a man, cannot learn if she does not listen and yield to the instructor, right? So there are obviously times when you have to listen. It depends on the setting. And there are times when you have an obligation to speak the truth, right? So we do both. We listen and we speak the truth. We can't learn if we don't listen. But it's interesting because in this statement, women are expected to learn and speak the truth just like men. in Bible times. At any rate, I could talk the whole time about this one concept, but I need to cover the rest of this commentary. I'm sorry. The service of the priests in the temple were accompanied by silence. The Levites sang in the courtyard, but the priests, unlike their counterparts in other ancient religions, neither sang nor spoke while offering the sacrifices. One scholar has accordingly spoken of the silence of the sanctuary. The Zohar speaks, this is a mystical work, the Zohar speaks of silence as the medium in which both the sanctuary above and the sanctuary below are made. There were Jews who cultivated silence as a spiritual discipline. Breslov Chassidim meditate in the fields. There are Jews who practice Ta'anit Dibur, a fast of words. Our most profound prayer, the private saying of the Amidah, is called Tefillah Belachash, the silent prayer. But of course, it's not silent, right? We utter the words aloud when we say it. We just utter them aloud quietly. So that when 100 people utter quietly the words aloud, there is still a kind of a low but noticeable noise level in a synagogue when the silent Amidah is being read. Okay? So, it's just like with many things, Hebrew concepts just don't fit into Western boxes. Because if it was the silent Amidah, then you wouldn't hear a sound during the time that the Amidah is being prayed, right? But of course, you do hear a sound because it's not silent. It's only called silent Amidah because it's supposed to reflect a time when you, as an individual, as opposed to the congregation, recites a prayer. In other words, it's your time with God. It's your time to be silent before God. Not talk, but to be silent before God. Do you understand? Anyway, it is based on the precedent of Hannah praying for a child. She spoke in her heart, her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Okay? From 1 Samuel. And anyway, God hears our silent cry. In the agonizing tale of how Sarah told Abraham to send Hagar and her son away, the Torah tells us that when their water ran out and the young Ishmael was at the point of dying, Hagar cried. Yet God heard the voice of the child. Earlier, when the angels came to visit Abraham and told him that Sarah would have a child, Sarah laughed inwardly, that is, quietly or silently. Yet she was heard by God. God hears our thoughts even when they are not expressed in speech. So, silence in Judaism can mean not expressing yourself in speech, but the meaning of the concept of silence is very big, right? It's not limited to this concept of not talking. The silence that counts in Judaism is thus a listening silence. And listening is the supreme religious art. Listening means making space for others to speak and be heard, which is mostly Paul's point in what he writes about the way worship should be conducted in his letter to the Corinthians. As I point out in my commentary to the Siddur, there is no English word that remotely equals the Hebrew word shema, shin, mem, ayin, in its wide range of senses. To listen, to hear, to pay attention, to understand, to internalize, and to respond indeed, right? Indeed, in doing. Those are all ways that we would translate the Hebrew root, Shema. Okay? You're familiar with it, Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel. I mean, we always translated it. We always translate it here, but it could be translated, pay attention, O Israel. Understand, O Israel. Internalize, O Israel. Respond indeed, O Israel. Right? This was one of the key elements in the Sinai covenant when the Israelites, having already said twice, all that God says we will do, then said, all that God says we will do, and we will hear. They nishma. Right? Understand. It is the nishma, the listening, hearing, heeding, responding, that is the key religious act. Because it's the act that facilitates a sense in our heart regarding what we're doing. Thus, Judaism is not a religion of doing and speaking. It is also a religion of listening. Faith is the ability to hear the music beneath the noise. There is the silent music of the spheres about which Psalm 19 speaks. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the works of His hands. Day to day they pour forth speech. Night to night they communicate knowledge. There is no speech. There are no words. Their voice is not heard. Yet their music carries throughout the earth. Right? There is the voice of history that was heard by the prophets. And there is the commanding voice of Sinai that continues to speak to us across the abyss of time. I sometimes think that people in the modern age have found the concept of Torah from heaven problematic. Not because of some new archaeological discovery, but because we have lost the habit of listening to the sound of transcendence, a voice beyond the merely human. It is fascinating that despite his often fractured relationship with Judaism, Sigmund Freud created in psychoanalysis a deeply Jewish form of healing. He himself called it the speaking cure, but it is in fact a listening cure. Almost all effective forms of psychotherapy involve deep listening. Okay? Now, interestingly enough, it's also called the talking cure. And everybody who has ever taken a class in psychology understands the way this works, because a psychologist, what do they do with a patient? Part of the objective is to get them talking. Talking about what? The weather? You know? Hey, what about them Giants? Or what about them Dodgers? You know? Did you feel the earthquake yesterday? I mean, is that what they talk about when they get together? Of course not. They talk about deep-seated feelings, right? What's supposed to happen in psychoanalysis has more to do with listening than it has to do with talking. It's about a person's ability to really discern what is going on in their heart in a way that makes it possible for them to talk about it, right? And in fact, a good clinician, a good psychologist, a good, you know, whatever you want to call them, their skill at getting people to talk about and identify, maybe I should have put it identify and then talk about, what they're really struggling with, that's what makes them good, right? So, this statement is a good one. The speaking cure, the talking cure, by the way, now, of course, psychologists write about the writing cure. In other words, because of the degree to which journaling and writing also facilitates healing too, right? I mean, so that's becoming more and more popular as well. But at any rate, it's actually a listening cure. Almost all effective forms of psychotherapy involve deep listening. Is there enough listening in the Jewish world today? Do we in marriage really listen to our spouses? But of course, he goes on to ask, do we as parents truly listen to our children? Do we as leaders hear the unspoken fears of those we speak to lead? Do we internalize the sense of hurt of the people who feel excluded from the community? Can we really claim to be listening to the voice of God if we fail to listen to the voices of our human beings? In his poem, In Memory of W.B. Yeats, W.B. Auden wrote, "In the deserts of the heart, let the healing fountain start." And of course, by this, Auden means, in the quiet place in the heart, let the healing fountain start. Right? And it's interesting that he connects very Jewish concepts together. Because the desert, of course, is the place of quietness. The quietness of the heart is where healing occurs. And it's interesting because he speaks about it as a fountain, which, of course, we associate with living water. Right? I mean, all of these ideas are very Hebraic, very Jewish. From time to time, we need to step back from the noise and hubbub of the social world and create in our hearts the stillness of the desert, where, within the silence, we can hear the kol demama deka, the still small voice of God telling us we are loved, we are heard, we are embraced by God's everlasting arms, we are not alone. Okay? So, let me, anybody would like to ask a question, has a comment, you have to indicate so I can unmute your microphone. So just put your hand up and I'll unmute your mic. Okay? Because if I unmute everybody's mic, the noise will be overpowering. We have to, because we'll hear everything. We just need to have one person talk at a time. So, anybody? Comment? Yes, hold on, let me...
Hi, Bob, how are you?
I feel a little bit spent today. I love the study, and well, we have been discussing this with Claudia, you know, today early, about the silence and all that, and it was pretty amazing how the study connects all those dots, you know, and well, thank you for the study. It was amazing.
Good.
It's really hard to keep silent.
Yeah.
Right.
It is. Well, you know, it is hard to be quiet. There's no question about it. It is hard to be quiet. Right? And to experience a quietness. That's why it helps from time to time to go to a place where it is quiet. Right? And you're just not inundated with sounds and experiences and noise and things. It's important to be able to do that. Anyway, good. Thank you. Other comments? Okay, Roderick, let me... There we go.
There we go. So I'm reminded of something that I read in Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, and his work that he did coming out of the Holocaust in Auschwitz and as a survivor. And Frankl talks about that between ourselves and exposure, and what he means by exposure is the adversity or the thing that causes our anxiety to increase or amp us up or maybe in some cases even make us angry or sad. That in that between ourselves and the exposure there is a space. And it's in that space that we can be intentional and not breach our integrity. And it's a powerful insight that Frankl gathered from his experience in the death camps, witnessing his family and many friends and many others and die, not knowing that he would ever survive, not knowing how to survive at times. And for him to make such an observation in such a setting provides a real powerful insight. And I see, and I felt that as in this lesson, and you were reading through the article there, and about that space, and being able to, that faith is being able to hear the music that's beneath the noise. And in the practice that I have, and I work in the world that I work in, it's, we talk a lot about self-awareness that leads people to self-regulation. And I coach and work with a lot of parents who have children who've experienced trauma. And one of the things that I want to help parents understand is that you cannot help lead your child from chaos to order or from dysregulation to regulation unless you, the parent, are already there. We can't lead our children to some place that we're not already there. It's the same idea of when you're flying on an airplane and there's a loss of cabin pressure and you're traveling with a minor, who gets the mask first, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, good one. Good. You know, when we read that sentence, faith is the ability to hear the music beneath the noise, I thought of, I love going to symphonies. I love classical music and I very much enjoy listening to classical music live. But one of the things that I always try to do is to hear the individual instruments. It's sometimes difficult to hear the individual instruments and to be able, I do that when I listen to it on the radio too. I try to identify, oh, that's an oboe or that's the violin or that's the cello or whatever. But it's like that. It, you know, faith is like that. It requires in some ways that you be able to distinguish the truth from all of the noise around us, you know, from so much of the noise that seeks to kind of distract us from what's really going on. Yeah. Other comments?
Okay, I'm not trying to stir the pot here. It's kind of a political question, and it's not a pro-Trump or anti-Trump. I'm just using something currently in the news as maybe an example that you can expound upon what you were talking about not speaking, that concept, when to speak, not to speak, and so forth. Just recently, I don't know if it was during the week or last week that Trump made a comment about the MS-13, about them specifically. And I believe his comment was taken out of context, but that he called the members of the Salvadorian gang, MS-13, those that kill, rape, and torture, and so forth, for basically for fun, he called them animals. Based on what you taught today, was that, do you consider, I'm kind of asking your opinion, that comment inappropriate, or what's your thoughts on that?
Okay, that's a tough question. It is not inappropriate to identify, identify a problem in society. It's not wrong to characterize or to speak about a problem as a problem. And by the way, it could have to do with anything, right? I remember years ago, it was like Obama's reluctance, well, not reluctance, he just flatly would not refer to Islamic terror as Islamic terror, right? Even when it was perpetrated by Islamic terrorists, Right. He always referred to it in, as some form of religious extremism, which of course it was. And there are other religions have extremists within their ranks as well, right? But not nearly, at least now, not nearly as many as you find in Islamic circles, right? So calling the kind of terrorism, you know, that we see on 9/11, right, or the blowing up of that concert venue in France, or that Jewish market in France, referring to that as the act of an Islamic terrorist, that's what you should call it, because they were Islamic terrorists, right? In this particular context, Trump called members of this gang animals, because they behave like animals. What's sad to me is that they behave in a vicious way like animals. That was his point. Not that they're not human, not that they're not animals. He was saying that they behave viciously like animals behave, right? And he certainly wasn't talking about all immigrants, which is what has been reported now endlessly since he made that statement in the press. I mean, and I've heard over and over and over and over again, people mischaracterize what he says as applying to all immigrants when he wasn't talking about all immigrants. I mean, it's kind of frustrating. It's a little like many, many years ago when I was leading a congregation, I was regularly interviewed by a newspaper, by a reporter, for an article on the holidays, or Passover was coming up, or you know, something would happen in Israel, and I was among those in the community at the time who was asked for to express some ideas about a particular subject for an article that was going to appear in the newspaper, right? I was always astonished, and in fact stopped doing interviews, because every single time I read an article in the paper, right, I thought to myself, who did you talk to? You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, you talked to me, but what you said, I said, are not the things I said. And then, of course, I would have to write a letter to the editor, and I'd have to explain, a misrepresentation in the article. And it was just mind-boggling it was almost 100% of the time my comments were misrepresented in whatever article was ultimately written. And I would always have to write some article to counterbalance what I was reported to have said in whatever article was published in the newspaper or in the magazine. And finally, I just got to a point where I said, no, I'm not doing this anymore. And I would talk to the person. I said, you are going to write down what I actually said, right? I mean, I would get them to agree in advance. Yes, I will faithfully represent what you say. And not a single time did they faithfully represent what I said. Never. It was, you know, it was just, anyway, it's, frankly, in my view, the president does say more things than he should. I would be happier if he didn't tweet, and if he didn't do a lot of things, right? But misrepresenting what he says is just as bad, maybe worse.
Okay.
Right?
Thank you.
Okay. Other comments? Yeah, the political world in which we live has gotten so out of hand. It's sad. You know, left and right are so polarized these days. It's just sad. You know. In Judaism, we have a concept of arguing. In fact, they're doing a series of studies at the synagogue on arguing for the sake of heaven and what that means. Arguing for the purpose of coming to terms with the truth. But in our political discourse these days, it doesn't seem like many people are concerned with the truth. You know, I mean, it's just... it's more important who's right. It's gotten very, very frustrating. It makes you you want to move to somewhere where you're completely isolated from everything. Yeah, Joseph, go ahead.
I thought earlier when you started the study, did you mention about Shavuot being Monday? But I thought it started tonight at sundown.
It could. Yeah, it starts tonight at sundown.
Yes.
So it's tomorrow. Shavuot is tomorrow.
Correct.
But starts tonight at sundown, yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Any other comments? I guess that's it. I appreciate all of you participating. It's very, very nice to see your faces. It's a lot easier to talk than it is to chat, to type. Of course, it makes for a longer study, but that's okay too. So, Baruch Hashem, if I don't end the meeting in the next 30 seconds, it's going to end by itself. So I will say, good to see everyone. Have a wonderful rest of your Shabbat. Have a good evening, and Lord willing, I will see you on Thursday night. Or next Shabbat, Shabbat Shalom. Leitrot.